Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it.
Welcome to our second hour here in Circles of Change. We're going to double back and kind of catch up on something we focused on in our first segment with Mark Samley, which was the whole area of managing expectations. And we're connect with a real master of more than managing expectations, but guiding them really in the direction we want to go. So I'd like to welcome, second time on our show, Bob Mayer. Welcome to Circles of Change, Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Zara.
Well, it's a pleasure. Bob conducts negotiation, mediation, and persuasion seminars and workshops in both the U.S. and abroad. Principles, skills, and progressive methods that actually honed over 40 years as a lawyer. Known as the lawyer's lawyer, Bob earned both a business and a law degree from the University of California, Berkeley. He's recently retired from the practice of law. His firm is known for bringing creative solutions to some pretty complex legal problems, representing clients both big and small, and negotiating deals on everything from amphitheater developments to the sale of vintage aircraft. So with a passion for applying those same skills and insights to everyday life, Bob has authored three books, and our topic today is his book, How to Win Any Negotiation Without Raising Your Voice, Losing Your Cool, or Coming to Blows. He's a much sought-after radio figure, appearing on more than 160 radio shows coast to coast, including CNN and Weekend Today in New York. And we're, of course, delighted he's choosing to add Circles of Change a second time to his list. So welcome again, Bob.
Thank you.
Well, you know, you've got these two books that are very similar, except for the one word. One is How to Win Any Argument, the other is Any Negotiation. So what's the relationship of these two books, Bob?
Well, the relationship is that when you're negotiating, it really has two components. Not only do the terms and conditions have to be acceptable, but I have to have enough trust in you, Zara,
yeah,
to know that you're going to come through.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're talking about trust being an emotional response to how you are. And how do you create trust? It's not enough that the terms and conditions are acceptable. I have to know that you'll be there Thursday morning and that you'll start doing the remodeling with first-class materials, and I don't have to worry about your not being there or coming with a bunch of, you know, inferior materials to do that remodeling job. I need to be able to trust you.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's one thing we write down, so to speak, or we, you know, put in those kind of boundaries, but then it comes to living that. You know, Bob, your book, of course, is sectioned in two major sections, and you talk really right out of the chute, though, that this is a lot about the art of the velvet glove, as opposed to some people picture that word negotiation to mean, you know, the tried and true hard, you know, fast Perry Mason attorneys, you know, that are contractually negotiating.
Well, you know, an important component of being an effective negotiator is setting the right tone and mood. And so that means that you're not going to want to overwhelm the other person. You're going to want to underwhelm them. You want to hit the ground walking. Mediators who are, you know, professional negotiators resolving disputes set a tone and mood invariably by putting muffins on the table, so when the various disputant parties come in, you know, they're talking about last night's baseball game. They're talking about, well, which kind of muffin do you want? And that's all part of the process of setting a tone and mood so everybody is malleable on the other side. You know, a good example of that is this idea. It's a time to, you know, become very personal with the people that you're negotiating with. And if you'll ever notice, if you've ever gotten a letter from a tax collector, they don't use their first name. It's always J. Smith or R. Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've ever been stopped by a policeman, you'll notice that on their name tags, they never have their first name. And that's because if I could say to the policeman that just pulled me over, oh, look, Joe, you know, I won't do it anymore. I was really in a hurry not to be late. Then Joe may be more inclined not to give me the ticket. But if I have to say, you know, look, Officer Smith, He is still going to write that ticket because I haven't personalized any interfacing with him. So that's part of the process, is underwhelming, personalizing, listening to the other person. I was just talking to a friend of mine who teaches UCLA medical students how to interface with their patients. And the medical students learn you don't talk to a patient from the foot of the bed. Mm-hmm. You get a chair and move right up next to their head. You want to personalize that relationship as opposed to just being a doctor at the other end.
Yeah, because in the process, you're really trying to set that full stage, aren't you? I love this, the use of muffins. I mean, in the corporate world, I used to always say, have cookies and they shall come. You know, number one, just to get them to come to the meeting. But there was something about setting that and being mindful of the light in the room or music in the background or other things that could, you know, just intensify
Absolutely.
The fracas factor.
You know, I have this... notice from the Los Angeles County Bar that went to all of its various members, and they do that occasionally by email to pass on tips to the lawyers. And I want to just read two sentences to you. Everybody's still on edge about the economy, making negotiations tougher and more highly competitive. This often ends in stalemates and sometimes broken deals and relationships. Well, you know, that's what this is all about, is that, you know, as negotiations become tougher, the relationships become more strained, and with strained relationships, it's harder to make a deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So setting that stage. And the other, you know, you slide in from that part of your book into now really troubleshooting. And I loved how you said and launched and framed this up as settling for more. So this is about manage your expectations, right?
Well, it is. But perhaps most importantly, you want to be able to impact the other person's expectations. So let me give you an example. I was hired by the state of California to give some advice to tax collectors, for the state. And amongst the things that we teach them, again, not to use their first names on any correspondence or business cards, but, you know, also to let the other person know that, gosh, Ms. Larson, you know, you and I have been negotiating over this tax delinquency now for 2 or 3 months, and I have to tell you that this case is going to be taken over by our supervisor, who is really tough, and I'm telling you, you don't want to deal with our supervisor. So if at all possible we can get this tax issue resolved today, that would be, I think, a real benefit for you. So what I've just done is that I've given you the expectation that things are going to get worse,
Tougher, yeah. And
that light at the end of the tunnel is a fast-moving freight. Expectations. We were giving some advice to a dating service. And, you know, if you say, hey, this guy, you know, is really great looking, has an amazing personality, you know, when some fellow comes knocking at your door and he doesn't look like Brad Pitt and has the most wonderful personality in the Western world, you're going to be disappointed because your expectations to join the service and what's being delivered at your front porch are totally different. You know, there's an interesting two story. Joshua Bell is one of the two or three great violinists in the United States. He just played at the Hollywood Bowl here in Los Angeles, and the tickets were probably starting around $70-$75, I would imagine. But as an experiment, they take Joshua Bell and his Stradivarius, and they put him at a metro stop in Washington. And he's there in a T-shirt and jeans, and he's playing the violin. And he had his open Stradivarius case, and people would throw change and dollar bills or so, whatever it is, into the case. And at the end of an hour, you know how much money he got?
How much?
$32.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And that's because nobody expected, you know, one of the world's great violinists to be in a metro station, so they didn't stop or listen. So, again, you know, we're guided by our expectations. There was an experiment at MIT with the MBA students where the MIT students were told that the cafeteria was thinking about changing its brand of coffee and wanted to know what the students think. So they had two different sample trays. The first sample tray that they put out, they had paper cups and plastic spoons and packs of sugar and a glass creamer, and the students said that the coffee was just okay. Then they took that tray away, and for the next group that came through, the coffee was on a silver tray, and they had, you know, silver spoons, and the creamer and the sugar canister, you know, were all silver, but it was the same coffee. And the students said, "Hey, this is great.
Great coffee, yeah."
Because they were expecting it to be great when it was served from a silver tray as opposed to being served from plastic cups. And so that's what it's all about, is happiness is a function of expectations.
Mm-hmm. You're stepping in those negotiations, that's so important. You also, in your book, really drive home this point about your role, that you as the messenger and the message are so intertwined, aren't they?
Absolutely. Again, because it's a totality, not just what you have to say, but how you say it and whether I can trust you. You know, you can give me the best terms and conditions in the whole world, but if I don't believe you, what good is it? So, you know, again, content is a totality. You're both the messenger and the message.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're speaking with Bob Mayer, by the way, who's written several books. The one we're focusing on today is How to Win Any Negotiation Without Raising Your Voice, Losing Your Cool, or Coming to Blows. And in fact, if you're on the internet with us, go to thewaytowin.net or rdmayer.com. Bob, of course, most people think about negotiations as, okay, tell me some of the tips and tricks, and this is about manipulation and catching people off guard and so on. Your book does include some of those hints, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a book of tips and tricks and tactics. Some people will say it's a book about how to be manipulative. Other people will say it's a book about learning how not to be manipulated.
Yes.
And so, it's a different world out there. And so, again, things are tougher, and you want to be able to understand what's happening. Let me just give you some common examples of things that, you know, your listeners may want to be aware of. You know, anybody who's ever bought a car may have experienced what's called the missing man maneuver. And that's where you sit there and make a deal with a very personable salesperson. And he says, "Hey, I just have to get the manager's approval, but it looks like it's a done deal, Zara." And he comes back 5 minutes later and says, "You know, the manager said, you know, with the trade-in allowance we're giving you for your present car, we have to, you know, change this deal around a little bit. You're going to have to pay another $400. Well, you know, that was all contrived. There is oftentimes no missing man in the back room at all. It's just that the salesperson has gone back there and spent a few minutes visiting with his buddies in the coffee room and come out and said, "Hey, darn it, I can't believe it, but I just can't make the deal the way it is." Well, you're already committed to buying that car, so another $300 or $400 or $500 isn't going to make a big deal. Those are the kinds of things you have to watch out for. Another thing, you know, that people do, and I'm trying to, you know, find things that might have a big appeal to your listeners.
Sure.
Is I once had a client say, "Bob, I want you to draft the most onerous, hard, difficult lease that you can possibly ever draft. Make it all one-sided, all for the landlord." And I did that. And so I turned the lease over to the client, and he said, "Hey, this is really great, but I just want to add two words." And I said, "Well, what are those two words you want to add?" He said, "I want you to put up at the top, standard lease." Well, nobody negotiates things that are called standard. And he said, "You know what I'm going to do is I'm going to have this printed up, because nobody, you know, negotiates what's standard, don't even read what's standard. Nobody questions the printed word, so
exactly,
it's worth having
they just
it printed.
Take it. Ah.
So those are the kinds of things that, you know, that people have to be aware of. And the other person's going to manipulate your expectations. So, for example, teaching insurance adjusters, let's just pretend that, you know, you were an offender bender, not your fault, and you're hoping to get $5,000, which you think is a pretty reasonable offer to expect, and you already have plans for maybe walking the sands in the south of France with that money, and here you go. The insurance adjuster may think that your case is really worth $5,000, but he's taught to offer you $1,500, because if he offers you $1,500, you're not thinking you're getting $5,000 anymore. You might be really happy to get $3,500, whereas if he offers you $3,500 to begin with instead of $1,500, you know you can get $5,000. So those are how numbers are manipulated, and again, impacting your expectations. So that's what the book is about, and making everybody sensitive to the kinds of ploys and gambits and plays that are out there. And just because they're made with a smiling face doesn't mean, you know, that you can't resist or be sensitive to what's happening.
Well, Bob, you're a real student of this negotiation process and obviously of contracts, having been a lawyer. But I also know, you know, you picked up a lot of these insights by traveling the world and watching, you know, the master negotiators in the markets, open air markets. And so my question would be, you know, how is it that in some cultures it's acceptable to haggle and negotiate, where in others it just doesn't seem to be the case?
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting aside, because right now it's a very small world. And it used to be that we would, you know, tell people jumping on a plane to go to Korea or Vietnam or Japan, China, you know, what to look out for and to understand how that other fellow negotiates that you're doing business with. But, you know, today you could be sitting at your keyboard and negotiating with somebody in Beijing that you've never met. And so you have to understand, you know, some of the cross-cultural problems of negotiating a bigger deal. And again, that's a whole separate topic, and it really depends with whom and the ages of the people. But you have to be sensitized to the fact that, you know, maybe bargaining is not something that you do here, but, you know, very commonly expected elsewhere. But, you know, again, part of the mystique, though, and part of the problem and part of the myth is that, well, you can't bargain here because we live in America. But in fact, you can. You know, you can bargain at Sears and say, look, you know, I don't want to pay that much for a refrigerator, but, you know, maybe maybe you have a floor sample that I could buy at a substantial discount. And all of a sudden, they may create a floor sample. But you would never think about negotiating at Sears, whereas, you know, they may, you know, welcome the opportunity to discount to make the sale, but they're just not going to do it unless you give them a reason.
Right, and like you say, you know, what's on your mind, you need to ask. Bob, the fourth part of your book, again, we're speaking about the book, How to Win Any Negotiation. You've done a really nice job. You call it the Dealmaker's Playbook, and you, in fact, outline 36 common negotiation encounters, everything from appliances, as you just mentioned, down to the things related to jobs. So job interviews, you know, salary increases, the things in the career front. You know, are these techniques that transferable, I'll say?
Absolutely, because we're talking about people. And, you know, people are people, and people have expectations, and people have concerns, and people need to make deals. And in fact, it's, you know, more deals are being made this year than 5 years ago, because if the deals aren't made, you may not be in business next week.
You're saying more deals, meaning people are willing to move off the mark for what's printed on the tag.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And you know, it doesn't matter whether, you know, it's a major appliance store or a car dealer or maybe even a boutique where they haven't had anybody walk in for the last 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, there's a lot of your tips and tricks, of course, and I'm sure our listeners are thinking, I wonder how this applies to my negotiating with my teenager, or if there's a teen listening, how do I negotiate my curfew better with my parents? These techniques absolutely apply in the same place, don't they?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
In part, they do. You're right about that. On the other hand, you want to preserve the relationship. Yeah. So, you know, it's okay to It's okay to take a chance and blow the relationship with the Ford dealer by negotiating too hard, because you can go down the street and there's another Ford dealer. But if it's a daughter who won't study, and you're negotiating with her like, I'll let you use the car on Sunday afternoon to go to the mall if you study, then you're creating a whole different set of issues and a whole different set of problems. And you want to preserve that relationship, and you still want to have a father or mother-daughter relationship, and so you're going to negotiate really somewhat differently. Not necessarily softer, but in a way that's going to preserve the relationship. And the book goes into several chapters on, you know, dealing with family and friends, because it is different.
Mm-hmm. Bob, when this book first came out, what year was that?
Oh, wow. In the 60s. And you know, it's interesting. The first time the book came out, it was for Random House. And Random House said, we want the word power in the title.
Okay.
And so one of the original books I did had the word power in the title, because people were selling power and publishers were still selling power then. But times have changed. Power is not an important word now, because it's not a matter of busting through. It's a matter of finessing a result. And that's what the book is all about. You know, the New York Times said that the style of my books is mental judo, and that you use the other person's energy to win and to tap into that energy, as opposed to beating them over the head. There are a lot of people who are really hate to negotiate. My wife is one of them. She goes and hides in a corner when I go to a car dealer. And so, you know,
well, she's just letting you be you. She's just letting you be the star. Come on.
Well, maybe, but she's not comfortable negotiating.
And many of us aren't, because we feel we don't have the inside track. In fact, you even comment here that your book really is about how can we tip the scale in our favor before we even get into having to balance.
Right, but if you learn how to negotiate in a way that where you're using the other person's energy rather than your own to win, you're going to be comfortable. And again, you're going to be more comfortable understanding all the tricks and ploys that are so common out there, because you understand what the playing field looks like.
Right. You know, the other thing, so this was 1960s to here we are basically 40 years later, right? By the copy I have in my hand, it says it was released in 2006. That really, over these 40 years, there's been a tremendous amount of advances in understanding of things like psychology, linguistics, let alone different techniques that work more effectively in trials, sales, and management communication from your own background. So the journey of writing the book the second time, did it come to you easily, or did you have to really kind of stop and reflect back?
A third time.
A third time, excuse me.
The book that preceded that, called Power Plays, which is no longer in print, but that was, but you know, it's interesting. Times have changed and people negotiate differently. The older people in your audience negotiate probably the way their fathers did and their grandfathers did, which was, and the byword was caveat emptor. When I was a young freshman at Berkeley a million years ago and took a business class, caveat emptor was the byword of the class. That is Latin for let the buyer beware. Mm-hmm. Well, that's no longer the case. People negotiate differently, and the reason your grandfather or your dad negotiates differently than you do is that, you know, the families may have come from small towns and villages in Europe, and you had to bargain hard, otherwise you didn't have a chicken to put on the table that night.
That's right, and times catch a different way.
Different culture, right, that they brought to, you know, our shores, and it didn't change how they negotiated once the plane, or once the ship, I should have said, landed at Ellis Island.
Exactly right. Well, Bob Mayer, thanks again for enlightening our listeners. How to win any negotiation without raising your voice, losing your cool, or coming to blows. You can learn more about Bob's work on thewaytowin.net, as well as rdmayer.com. Thanks for educating us further today, Bob. We'll be looking forward and keeping in touch.
Sounds good, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Bob. Bye-bye.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsengroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.